This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Get a peek of a new exhibit at the McLean County Museum of History showing off one of the largest collections of toy vintage vehicles in the country.
This exhibit for the next couple of years and then many years into the future will help support this institution. Just makes it so special.
Kevin Callis talks about his father Bruce's collection of pedal cars with GLT correspondent Colleen Reynolds. Laura Kennedy walks you through a new exhibit at University Galleries. It's a blinged-out objection to violence and injustice. And Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner is in the studio talking about funding for road repairs, a search for a new city manager and police chief, and clearing the way for a key position at the BCPA. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's March 13th, 2018. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Bloomington aldermen have made some long-awaited decisions about the future of its Performing Arts Center, the Creativity Center, and a clogged intersection on the city's Far East Side. GLT's Ryan Denham has more with Bloomington's mayor.
The mayors of Bloomington Normal stopped by GLT's Sound Ideas following their regular and special city council meetings. Mayor Terry Renner, thanks for coming in today.
Thanks. Great to be here. Thanks.
Well, let's start with the votes last night. Aldermen voted 7-2 in favor of an agreement between the city and the Friends of the BCPA, which is formally establishing a public-private partnership with this group of private citizens. Supporters say they hope this will jumpstart what they see as a stalled progress at the BCPA and Creativity Center. What does this agreement actually do?
Well, first of all, it's long overdue. I would absolutely agree with the supporters. This should have been done years ago. And the $1 million of private money that was raised for the Creativity Center was raised before I was even mayor. I was appalled that we had this money and it was just sitting there. This is private money earmarked for the Creativity Center, its programs and rooms, and yet the Cultural District Commission was powerless to move forward. And so I think this is a huge step forward. And I think that's the main thing. It's a similar, as many people noted, to our agreement with the zoo. Okay, we're going to kick in some funds. You're going to kick in some funds. Let's see how things make a transition, because the arts are critical. That corridor is critical. The BCPA, the frontier lots that are right by that, the Creativity Center, and, of course, the Electrolux site, that is a critical corridor for our downtown and exiting our downtown on Main Street and on the old Route 66 leading up through Illinois Wesleyan's campus. So the arts, again, it's not just about the arts. It's about economic development. It's about the physical development and amenities of our city. So I was very excited to see that this finally passed.
And this agreement calls for the city to finally fill this development director job, basically a fundraiser for the BCPA and Creativity Center. Are you comfortable with bringing on another city employee, given the lean budget system that you're in?
Let's be clear. This is a position that was budgeted back in 2014, and we did have someone in that position. And then because of the turnover and then the death of Tina Salamone, for a variety of reasons, this position was not filled. So this is a position that's in the budget. This is not a new position in the budget. And let's get clear. Be clear. It's about development. The person raises money. If they are really any good, they pay for themselves over and over. And so if we really are serious about moving forward and making Bloomington a better place to live, work, and play, if we're serious about investing in our community and the arts and amenities and the economic spillovers to that, I think this is an essential position. If the person doesn't perform, then you change the person. But absolutely, if you have tough economic times, the last person you want to get rid of is your development guy or gal.
And this passed 7-2 last night. So you had two no votes, one of them Alderman Diana Howman, the other Alderman David Sage. What did you think of those two no votes? And then Alderman Howman actually made a comment about her reasoning behind it.
You'd have to ask them. Again, I don't understand what the no votes were about. I still don't. So you'd have to ask them.
Okay. So getting back to this issue of you yourself called it a long overdue step toward making improvements at the BCPA. I guess why does this happen? I think a lot of folks in the city have seen this sort of delay on other issues. 15 months of talking about a welcoming city ordinance, for example. This situation with the BCPA. How would you characterize? I mean, why is that? Why does that happen?
There is definitely a long-standing culture, long before I was even mayor, but certainly. Mayor Stockton ran into that before me, I think somewhere or maybe around a decade or so ago, a culture developed of not moving decisively. And I think this is one of the reasons why I have suggested that the council members, all of them, go to the Illinois Municipal League, go to the National League of Cities, develop the equivalent of a dating myself, Rolodex of people that you can talk to in other places about the decisions that you're about to make so that you're prepared to come to a business meeting that is a city council meeting and actually make a decision. And now there are times where you need, of course, to stretch things out. There are some times where you need a lot of time to really digest something, but that doesn't have to be on everything. It doesn't have to take months or trash took us 7 years. That does not have to be part of your culture. And I think if our city council would have more of a broader comparative base, if they'd go to the Illinois Municipal League, National League of Cities, I think some of that would begin to happen. And I think that culture is beginning to change. We are moving forward. We are making progress. It may not be as quickly as I or some people would like, but we are moving forward.
That's Mayor Terry Renner from Bloomington. This is GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Also last night, aldermen voted to spend $370,000 to revamp the intersection of Ireland Grove and Towanda Barnes Road out on the east side. It's going to be smaller in scope and cheaper than previous iterations of this project. There's been some resistance to it before, so why do you think this scaled-down version of it finally passed last night?
Right. Well, I think you can... some resistance is probably being charitable, Ryan. I would have had to have vetoed the initial project. I actually broke the tie to say no to previous versions because I don't think we should be encouraging sprawl. And I that's one of the concerns that I have on this particular site. And it's also important for us to understand, initially, this is not what we agreed to. The intergovernmental agreement that I signed a year and a half ago was a fraction of the cost when it came back to us at $1.8 million. So we would have been on the hook for $900,000 of that. How do I go to people in other parts of Bloomington and say, oh, you know, your streets and your dangerous intersections that are more dangerous than this one within the city of Bloomington, we're not going to bother with yours, but we're going to bother with this one, and we're going to spend all this money. Then it got scaled back to $450,000. That's the tie that I broke. And at that point, I didn't think it was an unreasonable request. So that was a tough vote for me. And now that it's come back in a more scaled version at $370,000, I just signed it actually a few minutes ago before I came in, and that passed unanimously. There are some things that need to be done at that intersection. Some of the low-lying fruit had not been explored at that point, like making sure that you have traffic enforcement if people are going too fast. So there are some things that it does not do, but I think that it is a reasonable compromise for public safety without encouraging sprawl at that intersection.
So this is, as you mentioned, this is sort of a joint project between the city and McLean County.
That's
references
right.
intergovernmental agreement. It's been in the works for a couple of years. Last night's vote, how much of it was we want to actually improve this intersection thing versus we've got this intergovernmental agreement on the books. We've already have almost $100,000 into it. We just got to proceed regardless.
It was probably all of the above. But I think the main interest that obviously everybody on the city council, I mean, whether people agree or disagree on any given issue, everybody wants to prioritize public safety. So that was, and certainly in my mind, that was the main, if not the only reason, to go ahead with this. The reason I signed it, the reason I didn't speak against it, even though I had spoken against previous iterations of it before, is because of public safety. I think it is a reasonable compromise, again, without encouraging sprawl, without, frankly, subsidizing future developers on the east side, in areas that aren't even in the city of Bloomington. I mean, the days that we subsidize, new development are largely gone. And by say largely, there are some contracts that we're still stuck with.
Alderman Karen Schmidt raised an issue last night that saying she was concerned that this version of the project had not gone through the city's newish transportation commission.
That's correct.
But I thought previous iterations of it had gone through the commission. So which is it, first of all? And then are there any changes that you want to see to the process of how the citizen-led transportation commission gets to weigh in on projects that move through it and may have multiple iterations of themselves?
Yes. If I can answer the last one first, and that is I absolutely think that all projects should go through the Citizens Advisory Board, the TAC, Transportation Advisory Committee. I think that that's really critical. And that's one of the reasons why I supported it and the council supported the establishment of that. And so in the past, it had been the STAC, Staff Transportation Advisory Commission. So now we've brought citizens in, and you are correct. The previous iterations, and actually the most recent one, the $450,000 version of this, the Transportation Committee did approve with one dissent, and that was Michael Gorman. And Michael Gorman wrote a letter, who's the chair, and in support of this particular version of it. So it didn't go back to TAC, but the Transportation Advisory Commission had taken a look at it. And I think if they had supported it at $450,000, they probably would have supported it at $80,000 cheaper. Now, the reason we brought it back was not to avoid procedural niceties, but because the county needed to move quickly and they needed to have this at their next county board meeting to get approval in order to have this happen this summer. So that's the reason. Sometimes policy making is a little like sausage making. You sometimes don't want to know the details, but at the end of the day, I think we did follow the spirit of this. As we move forward, I think we need to follow not just the spirit, but the letter. We should not be doing an end run around the Transportation Advisory Committee composed of citizens who are supposed to give their feedback. When I ran, that's one of the things I said is, City Hall should be like windows, so that anybody from any part of town can look in, see what they're paying for, and if they want to get involved, we'll figure out a way to get them involved in the process.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned this, the email that Michael Gorman had sent. Michael Gorman is the chair of the Transportation Commission we've been talking about. He raised some questions and had concerns about the use of motor fuel tax and how this particular project was going to be funded and a change in how the funding was going to work. So I want to ask, does this project on the Far East Side to ease congestion, twice a day, ultimately, at the expense of is it at the expense of repaving long overdue roads in the heart of the city, ultimately?
Not directly, but there obviously when you're using funds, there are some indirect effects, but not directly. And so we will be able to go back and look at the other dangerous intersections and one in the Alderman Scott Black's ward as well. There are definitely some intersections that we have to look at. Frankly, that are more dangerous, at least in terms of injuries and fatalities, than this particular intersection.
Yeah, this intersection was described as the 10th most dangerous in the whole city.
Right, and that's news to me. I had heard that it was in the top 25. Now, it is the most dangerous intersection in the county, but the most dangerous intersection that's outside of Bloomington Normal in the county does not necessarily rack up and is not necessarily always on the top of our list. We've got lots of other dangerous intersections that we need to prioritize to protect our citizens within Bloomington.
Well, let's pivot now to the search for your next city manager. Now, you didn't take any action on this formally, but you got an update on the process for replacing David Hales, who left last year for that job in Joliet. What's the timeline now for a new hire?
Right. Well, this was GovHR, which was chosen, and they actually are a nationally known firm. They actually ran the search for the head of the International City County Management Association, where I used to work, which is a huge plum for them to have gotten. So that's one of the reasons why they were chosen. And we almost all of us met with the director of GovHR, one of the coordinator for GovHR yesterday, and talked about what we want out of a new city manager. The bottom line is that they will begin now to take our feedback, run by us a job description. They ran by us some essentially dollar amounts that we might, in terms of salary ranges that we might want to advertise if we want to attract the best talent. And so this will go out in a variety of ways. So people will be contacted directly, some groups of female public administrators, people who have color, so we can broaden our pool of candidates so that we can diversify our pool of candidates, will all be taken care of. Somewhere around June or July is when, you know, this may happen. But at the end of the day, you know, once you begin this process, you know, we still need to finish our budget process. So we're not going to be able to dive too heavily into this. And this is one of those situations until the very end, at the very end of the process, when you got your last three candidates, then you need to move quickly. But until that point, you don't really need to move quickly.
I want to play a clip from last night. This is Alderman Scott Black talking about the search and how quickly he wants to see it proceed.
I would just advocate for as quickly as possible. The sooner we get it posted, the sooner we bring it down, the sooner we can get going. We don't have time for a lengthy process. We got a lot of things going on right now.
So Alderman Black is an ally of yours on the council. Is that where you're at as well in terms of the speed of this search and how quickly to go? Because I think a lot of people are thinking, all right, we've got this interim city manager, Steve Rasmussen, already on the job. Why don't we just proceed quickly, get it done, and he's the guy.
Well, first of all, part of it is because I've been involved in this for over 30 years. I used to work for the International City County Management Association. I may be a little too close to the hiring process. And when I make mistakes as mayor, and I've made a lot of them, it's because I move too quickly. So I'm very sympathetic with wanting decisive action and do it yesterday, make stuff happen, right? When it comes to a city manager search, we do have this process laid out. There are some reasons why it's going to take us a few months to broaden our pool. If we move too quickly, we're not going to have as broad a pool as possible. So that's the only qualifier that I would add to Scott's comment.
One last question. We'll get you out of here, so I'll be brief. How transparent will the search be? When will the public know the finalists? In normal, when they did their search, the finalists weren't announced, only the new hire, Pamela Reese, was announced. What can you tell me about transparency?
The finalists will be announced, and I forgot the date. I don't have it in front of me, but it would be in fairly short order before the final selection. And that would be somewhere around 2 weeks, 10 days perhaps, and then the council would need to make their final selection. And up until that point, we do, for a variety of reasons, for the privacy of the people who are applying, keep their names confidential. But we would certainly like to hear from the public about what they'd like to have out of a new city manager. We have already. I've certainly heard lots of people say, you know, keep Steve Rasmussen, take the interim out of it, his title. So we have definitely heard people lobbying for Steve Rasmussen and what they'd like to see.
Mayor Renner, thanks for coming in today.
Thank you, Ryan.
Mayor Terry Renner from the city of Bloomington. I'm Ryan Denham.
And I'm Mike McCurdy. The mayors of Bloomington and Normal join us on most Tuesdays following Monday evening council meetings. Next week, you'll hear from Town of Normal Mayor Chris Coos. This is Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from the Advocate Charitable Foundation, which provides funding to help Advocate Broman Medical Center connect patients with world-class cardiology experts at convenient locations throughout central Illinois. Information at advocategiving.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. People strolling through the new Pedal Power exhibit at the McLean County Museum of History typically have wide eyes and mouths open in delight. The kids, too. The rainbow of colored, pint-sized autos polished to perfection represent one of the largest collections of many vintage vehicles in the country. Bloomington resident and State Farm executive Bruce Callis amassed and restored the classic pedal cars starting in 1988 until he passed away a decade later. GLT's Colleen Reynolds talked with son Kevin Callis and daughter Kim Callis Reedy about the passion that fueled the legacy Callis has left for others to enjoy.
Dad was a State Farm employee and had very long, hectic days. So he would tag along with my mom, who was an antique buff, to shows or shops and that kind of thing. He really wasn't much of an antique lover, but they ran across a 61 T-Bird, which was very similar to the one that they had purchased for us when we were children back in the late 60s. And Mom said, well, why don't you buy that and restore it? And he did. And that was the very first pedal car. And grandchildren came a few years later, and so did other pedal cars. He added one or two or even three a year and would start then learning more about pedal cars and the evolution of the pedal car. And so he would start looking for specific ones, and he ended up with a collection of about 80.
Kevin, how old were you when all of this started? Were you grown and out of the house, and this became a habit for your dad later in life, right?
It really was. We had probably come back from college and started our careers, and I think that's part of what inspired him to begin traveling the antique trail with my mother, looking for things to do together on the weekends. And, you know, the opportunity to find a rare one hidden in an antique store in a small town in southern Illinois or Missouri really became something that he became very passionate about. How to find them, learning the history of each car, and then studying a lot of the advertising from that period to figure out what were the available color schemes and which one of those did he want to recreate.
So what was it like to watch him with grandchildren and enjoying these different pedal cars?
It was wonderful. I was the only child that was in town, that was local, and so my husband Bob and my son Michael, who was a toddler when the collection started, he got a commercial garage because he outgrew the garage at home, and so he purchased a property and built a garage. And so my husband and my son were over weekends, evenings, traveling with him to scout out the latest and best ones. So for me, it was a wonderful way for my family, being local, to spend time with my folks.
Kevin, you mentioned your dad doing research, and did he pass along any of that information to the rest of the family?
It's mostly an oral history, right? And so at the time of his passing, we did, thanks mostly to Kim and Bob, a lot of research to make sure we understood what the inventory was. What were each of the cars? What were their histories? And a lot of the paperwork is probably now since gone. But, you know, when he would restore a car, in addition to figuring out the color scheme, there would be missing parts. And so it became an art, trying to figure out who you could go to for which parts based on the manufacturer, and then going through the advertising yet again to figure out the details of the different artwork that would be on the cars. So think of the decal work and having those many times recreated just from a picture so that the car could be returned to its original condition. There were great stories, and there was kind of a tradition that when he'd finish one up, when he and Bob and Michael would finish, we would come up from Springfield so the girls could go help Michael and Sarah later test drive these new cars.
Of course, there was always posing for pictures in the latest ones that were finished for the grandkids.
So as you walk through the exhibit and you see little kids and families enjoying these cars, how does that make you feel?
It makes us feel great as a family. Dad was very involved in the community and loved sharing his hobby. We would go to car shows. He also had full-size antique cars, so we would go with them to the local car shows and sometimes take pedal cars. And it was a real joy for him to watch his grandchildren interact with other children in the love of the pedal cars as well. And so it's a very special time for all of us. It's bittersweet. We have the garage that Dad had all these stored in. It's a little less full now, and so that's a little emotional, but we're thrilled to be sharing it on behalf of Dad, and we know he would be so supportive of this, and I think it's a wonderful place to have the museum create this exhibit.
Kevin, as you were walking through and looking at the display and how people were interacting with the cars, how did you react to seeing their reactions?
It really reminded me of our children, the big wide eyes that you see as the kids look at the different colors and the different designs of the vehicles. Seeing it here is really special. He had a fondness for the museum, the mission. He supported it in a lot of different ways over the year. So this is kind of a full circle. a personal passion with history, passion that he had for the museum. And to know that this exhibit for the next couple of years and then many years into the future will help support this institution just makes it so special.
You're listening to Sound Ideas. I'm Colleen Reynolds. And while it was great talking with Kim Callis-Reedy and Kevin Callis about their dad's pedal car collection, we also wanted to find out just a little bit more about the exhibit at the McLean County Museum of History. So we checked in with curator Anthony Bowman. Tell me what it was like when you first learned about the possibility of having pedal cars.
My first question is, I knew that the collection was a large one, so it's like, where are we going to put this and how are we going to display this? So I immediately thought about design, but as I was digging into the history, there is so much there. And one of the hooks I'm making with programming and with the actual exhibit themes is the history of manufacturing, history of design of these cars. And as far as the McLean County connection, Bruce Callis was a longtime resident from the late 60s, I believe, and executive at State Farm and also a member of many community groups. So that's really a strong personal connection that these cars kind of represent. I know the family's been very appreciative of being able to see that here. And furthermore, I tried to tie in the local history with Pantograph archives research and other things that I knew would represent kind of the local experience with pedal cars. So we have a Safety Town Interactive with a fire engine that kids can actually climb in, and with images of the older Safety Town that started in 1969 on the board behind them, so they can kind of step into Safety Town. And a lot of the people I've talked to remember being at Underwood Park and seeing that.
Tell me a little bit more about Safety Town, because some people might not be familiar, especially if they didn't grow up in Bloomington Normal.
So Safety Town, from what I've gathered, it was started in 1969, and it was sponsored by the Normal Police Department. And really, it's a miniature Normal, Illinois. It has Linden Street signs, it has stop signs, it has intersections. And the idea behind it was that you were going to teach, and the police were going to teach school children, usually kindergarten age or so, pedestrian and traffic safety. So we have similar things today, and Safety Town continues as a bicycle safety experience.
And there's also a strong State Farm connection. Talk a little bit more about that.
He took his hobby of restoring and collecting pedal cars to his professional life at State Farm by creating, with others, of course, a prototype State Farm pedal car using a Champion, I believe a 1950 or so Champion pedal car. So he got that customized and branded State Farm red and white with State Farm name on it and the logo. And that is actually what State Farm used to celebrate its 75th anniversary back in 97.
So you have sort of an industrial design for the exhibit with the cars stacked on metal storage containers, if you will. Where did that idea come from?
That really stemmed from how Bruce Callis and the Callis family had the cars stored at the garage. So they were in a garage. Bruce Callis had several actual vintage automobiles. So they're all kind of in this industrial space anyway. Our curator, Susan Hartsold, and I went out there, and she was really taken with how they displayed them kind of on metal racks and shelves. So we took that, and I kind of went that direction and did some research and tried to figure out what would be affordable and look good and kind of mimic that same aesthetic. And we came up with these gray metal storage shelves that look really good compared to the colors of the cars.
Right, because the colors pop.
Exactly. And again, thanks to Susan for her graphic design that kind of played off of those colors with the really bright, vibrant artwork.
So how many cars in all do you have on display? And was it difficult to pick from this huge collection?
So the museum received 53 of those cars from the Callis family. They kept a few for grandkids and sentimental reasons. We got 53. In all, 47 are displayed in this exhibit. That also includes one on loan from the family. And picking them was sometimes challenging, so I wanted to include as many as possible just because I thought that would look really neat, and it has turned out really well. But just some were duplicates that I didn't think told the story, because why have two if one would work and tell a really good story? So I picked the better of the two. Sometimes I picked one that was unrestored just to kind of give that before and after look. And some were not really pedal cars. For example, one was an electric battery-powered car. So that helped me kind of cull it down and focus on really the pedal cars and get a good representation of the 20s through the 70s and 80s. That was another factor, the age range I wanted to represent.
Do you have a favorite in the collection?
So you may notice, and anyone visiting may notice, this really large kind of photo op in the front. It's a blue it's a Stratojet. You'll see Stratojet written on it. It's got these really great chrome fins on the tail. But I reproduced that photo op. It's on like an aluminum panel from the real pedal car that's in the collection on display. So I've been drawn to those fins since the day I saw it. So I wanted to really use that everywhere. And actually, it's the same car used on our t-shirt making. So I'm really trying to get some mileage out of that one.
What do you do with this collection after the exhibit closes.
We're going to keep a couple for the collection, and otherwise they'll be used to support the museum.
You're going to be giving a presentation, Anthony. Is there anything else that is in your presentation that you wanted to share?
A lot of my inspiration for programming and also for my presentation comes from the industrial and mechanical and machinery aspect of these cars. So I consider them industrial works of art. They had actual industrial artists make these. There's patent drawings I'm going to show and patent drawings in the exhibit. And I really try to hit that a lot because I don't think, and I didn't at the beginning either, think of these really as creative endeavors. But yeah, someone had to make these, and there's real true artists behind these.
Anthony Bowman is curator for the McLean County Museum of History exhibit of pedal cars, and he spoke with GLT's Colleen Reynolds for Sound Ideas. Sound Ideas on GLT. I'm Mike McCurdy. Art can be a powerful form of protest, so it is with a new exhibit at University Galleries. It's a blinged-out objection to violence and injustice. GLT's Laura Kennedy has more.
A video of a carnival parade in Jamaica runs on a trio of screens against a wall of the University Galleries. A marching band moves down a crowded street in Kingston. Then a group of marchers appear, each hoisting a sculpture atop a pole. A coffin colorfully decorated in splashy fabrics, sparkling rhinestones, and fabric flowers. The works are from the artist Ebony G. Patterson. The sculptures carried in the parade are now on view at the University Galleries in Uptown Normal in an exhibition curated by Kendra Pates, who says the way Patterson addresses the subjects of violence and race with her colorful works translates across cultures.
She uses these really opulent materials, vivid colors, shiny objects to really draw you in. But then as you start reading about them, as you start looking at them more closely, you realize that there's something much deeper and darker underlying all of it.
These coffins that are propped up on these big sticks and stands have an amazing story behind them.
Yes, so what you see here are 50 coffin-shaped sculptures. This is only the third time they've all been brought together. A lot of places just don't have the space to show 50 of them at once, so I'm really happy that we're able to show all of them. So they're from a project called Invisible Presence Bling Memories, which Ebony did in 2014. So she collaborated with art students in Jamaica to create these and to infiltrate a carnival procession. In Jamaica, they do not have a very long carnival tradition, and she was really critiquing it and thinking about the history of protest and its importance in like longer carnival traditions. And in Jamaica, she said that the one they've adopted is very commercial and really exclusive.
So people maybe from the poorer neighborhoods aren't really included in on it.
Exactly. So the permits are incredibly expensive. The costumes are incredibly expensive. She said also the one they've adopted, the bikini mass, is also sort of the most superficial of the traditions. So she has made some works related to a really violent occurrence that happened in a neighborhood. And there were between 72 and 200 civilians killed. The number varies widely. The reports vary widely. And thinking about how those people were not really remembered or commemorated, we don't know much about their identities, their lives. And these coffins served a lot of purposes, thinking about violence, thinking about who people are. Aesthetically, they're rooted in the tradition of the bling funeral, where a lot of people from working-class neighborhoods in some Caribbean countries, in New Orleans, will plan these really elaborate funerals, she said, sometimes for years. And the quote she uses that I love is from an essay by Donna Hope, saying, "You may not have seen me while I was alive, but you'll damn well notice me when I'm dead," or something kind of along those lines. And sometimes they'll have their own marching bands. So Ebony worked with these students. They did a performance where they actually sort of marched behind the main procession.
Now, they would not have ordinarily been allowed into that procession. They basically were crashing it, right?
Yes. So she said that she did actually try to secure permits, but it's a private company who runs Carnival in Jamaica. They also put up barricades on the city streets so the public, you know, the people living in that neighborhood can't even use their streets. And so she told everybody to just wear their regular clothes or whatever they wanted because she wanted people to feel like they could join in and like they wouldn't be excluded because they didn't have the proper costume. Two people that she was collaborating with showed up in nun costumes, which she wasn't expecting, so that was really funny. But so they marched for 90 minutes with these coffins, mostly held high above their heads. She wanted there to be this very specific moment of presence, like suddenly here they are, and then this very specific moment of absence, like now we're done. They hired their own marching band, the St. Michael's Marching Band, who's playing different funerary songs from Jamaica. And so we have now those coffins that were a part of the performance. She's created stands for them. They're massive, you know, 10, 12 feet high. And then we have this three-channel video that she created.
Let's check it out.
So she made this in collaboration with Michelle Serio. And it is almost 10 minutes and shows you sort of a snapshot of that 90 minutes that they were there. So when it first starts, you see the coffins actually being kind of constructed, some fabric being stapled on. You know, so there's a wide variety of fabrics in all colors, all patterns, and then this crazy assortment of tassels, of chains, of sequins, of buttons. They're all very different from one another. You know, they each have this sort of individuality. And then when you see the video, you see a little glimpse into how they were made and then how they were all loaded onto a truck, how the group sort of joined in and made the procession. And you hear, really importantly, those songs and you see the marching band. And I love how it activates this space, how even if you don't read the materials that are provided, you can see in the video and get a sense of what was happening. And you hear that music throughout.
Did she get into trouble for doing this? I mean, did the security at the parade go, hey, wait a minute, I don't remember these guys on our list?
You know, I don't think they did.
So they got away with it.
I think they did, yeah. And it's great when, with having the videos too, you can see at one point a law enforcement officer or a security guard, somebody in uniform along the parade route, just sort of standing by. So you see how people sort of interacted with them. You see people along the sides, you see people walking up, you see this sort of enforcement officer watching. And you see some of the other people, they give glimpses of other participants in the parade as well.
How were they received in the parade?
I think people were excited. I think they were surprised. You know, I think people actually did join in with them, you know, felt like they could be a part of it.
Is this an extraordinary way to use art as protest, as to say, look, I don't like how things are in my country. I don't like the violence. I don't like the poverty. Does this really stand out to you?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's a long history of artists as initiators of protest or artists thinking of ways to sort of create a visual response or a performative response, something that can, sometimes a text-based response, something that can reach people on a different level than almost anything else. I think musicians are able to engage in protest in this way too, because there's something that grabs your attention and connects and forces this sort of deeper looking. And with Ebony, I mean, I really do think the materials draw you in. And, you know, she, in talking about the work, she said, I know when somebody hasn't paid attention to it, when they say, oh, it's so pretty, because just like it's not, sure, of course, but that's not what
you've got to get past that surface.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
That's Kendra Pates, senior curator at the University Galleries in Uptown Normal. Ebony G. Patterson's exhibition is currently on view until April 1st. I'm Laura Kennedy.
Hear bonus audio about more of Ebony Patterson's work and see photos from the exhibit at WGLT.org. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping individuals and families create solid plans for the future through a combination of investment options and life insurance. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Libertyville, Illinois claims a number of notable celebrities, including actor Marlon Brando and Tom Morello of the metal rap rock band Rage Against the Machine. It's also where Irish folk punk rocker Ike Riley grew up and where he still calls home. His band, the Ike Riley Assassination, plays the Castle Theater Thursday night. Though not a household name like Brando and Morello, Riley's band has a hardcore following and has had critics raving for years. GLT's John Norton caught up with Riley to talk music, Tom Morello, and how the core of his band has roots in Bloomington Normal.
You came into the world the day that all the kings died. I felt the heat in your heart, saw the flames in your eyes. For 3 days and three nights.
The song you're hearing is the title track to the latest album from the Ike Riley Assassination. It's called Born on Fire. And if the lyrics sound like maybe it's about one of his kids.
It is. It was inspired by one of my kids, but it's really about everybody's kid, I guess. And it's also about, you know, anyone that's been a kid, which hopefully we remember that, you know. You know, it was really written as an apology, you know, for not really believing in somebody that you should really believe in. So
who was that person?
Well, that was the kid I wrote it about. Well, I got one of my kids, so.
Okay. Ike, it's just a beautiful song. And when I first heard it, it just almost moved me to tears. It's that beautiful.
Well, thanks, man. I mean, that's my goal, to make everybody cry as much as I can.
Well, and I was assuming you're talking to your son in the song, but it also has a sound of someone maybe who has come to grips with their lot in life, or maybe come to grips with who they are.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's certainly, it comes from the standpoint of that the only thing you really have to offer somebody is their independence, and that they need to follow what they believe in and not let parents, teachers, priests, cops, politicians tell them what to do. They have to follow their, you know, it's a cliche. I don't really mean heart, but, you know, you have to follow what you believe in, and you're not going to, get by believing in mythical things like gods that occasionally show up to help you.
I can't leave you no money. I can't leave you no land. I can't leave you no faith. I lost a little I had. But I can leave you this truth. Hold on to hope and desire. And take your flames in the streets. Cause you were born on fire.
You and Tom Morello of Rage Against the Machine are friends, and it sounds like you guys go back a ways?
Yeah, my last record came out as a co-release on his label. He and I played a lot together in political and activism events, whether it's labor unions or, you know, food pantry fundraisers. But yeah, he's from my hometown of Libertyville, and his first professional gig was actually my wife's eighth grade graduation party. So
no kidding. Wow. I never saw Tom with Rage Against the Machine, but I did see him play in Audioslave, a little over 15 years ago now, up in Chicago. And what just struck me about it is he brought his mom up on stage. And she was a spitfire up there. She was dropping F-bombs, and she sounded like she was a trip to grow up with. And it sounds like you knew her as well.
Well, she was my teacher. She actually taught. I grew up in the white community of Libertyville, Illinois, and she taught African studies starting in the 70s all the way through the 90s to kids up here. And very influential woman. She doesn't drop F-bombs in her regular speech. She used to announce Rage as the best f***ing band in the world, you know.
Okay, all right. So she did that on a regular basis.
If she was at a show in Chicago and other places too, she would announce them. Now, she's not just Tom's mom. She was head of a group called Mothers for Rap, which was a group that came out against Tipper Gore's censorship of hip-hop music and all music. She's extremely political. She's 94 now, and she's still doing great. You know, she's an impressive lady.
Wow. Ike Riley is the voice you're hearing on GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton. Let's play a little bit of another song from your latest album, Born on Fire. Hanging Around is the name of this song.
You see a sweat in her factory, slung bags in her doorways. Song for her workers with a corporate whore's gaze. Just looking for work I don't hate with more pay. I'm changing my tune, but I'm not going away. You see,
you're sort of insinuating you're still a guy looking for a better job with better pay.
I love the job. I just need better pay.
Yeah. Let me go back. I mean, you've done so many cool things. You've literally been a grave digger. You've been, what, like a bellhop? You've been a concierge? You've done a lot of different things. But it sounds like you've been an artist at heart, at least, since you've been a teenager. How comfortable were you with that way back when, and how comfortable are you with that right now?
I think I was uncomfortable with it as a kid, you know, because I didn't really know, you know, why I felt certain ways. And so I would just drink and smoke weed to try to try. At first, the jobs, I had romantic views of labor, you know. You know, I mean, I was influenced by books and movies before I was really influenced by music. I knew that I really couldn't hold a job down. So I found jobs that allowed me to be artistic and have freedom to try to figure out whether I was going to be a writer or a musician or whatever. I didn't realize at the time that's what I was doing, but I was doing that. And I picked jobs that, you know, were thought-provoking in a way. I mean, I've been to thousands of funerals, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
As a spectator. Also, when I worked at the front door of the Hyatt in Chicago, I mean, literally, I would have interactions with hundreds of people every day, conversations with people from all over the world and strangers and cops and, you know, neighborhood folks. And so those conversations and observations kind of, you know, seeped into my psyche, and I puked them out as 3 to 4 minute songs.
Your power and your mischief. Then the workers went home and the lights went down. And a deal was made. Yeah, I sold out. I sell out tomorrow, last night and today. I'm changing my tune, not really going away. You see, I've been hanging around for a long time. On the outside.
This is GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton. Ike Riley and the Assassination in town March 15th at the Castle Theater. We're talking with Ike Riley right now. And you've got our hometown guy, Tommy O'Donnell, playing with you again at the Castle Theater. You want to give some props to Tommy on his hometown public radio station?
I really don't. I don't think he deserves it. No. Actually, my connection to that town is crazy. Tommy, if you don't know, listeners of the Bloomington Normal area, is one of the greatest guitar players I certainly know and maybe heard. And my other bandmate, Phil Karnatz, is also from Bloomington Normal, and Tommy was his guitar teacher when they were kids. He's been playing with me since forever. He's also been successful in a band called the Polyphonic Spree, Tripping Daisy, and I guess Secret Machines are another fantastic one. And my new record that's coming out May 18th is called Crooked Love, and Phil produced that with me. Phil also produced Born on Fire with me. But that Bloomington Normal, whatever it is down there, has given me not only two of the greatest musicians I've played with, but two of my best friends, for sure.
The final song I want to play is Paradise Lane from the album Born on Fire, and it's an ode to your hometown of Libertyville, Illinois. And I looked it up. There really is a Paradise Lane in Libertyville.
There's a Paradise Lane, and Max and Jake were a couple of kids that rolled a car over on Paradise Lane.
Sometimes you burn
Sometimes you get a second chance, but most times you don't get a turn.
And now, this is actually funny. They were in a band. They're just about 20 and 21 years old. Max now is our go-to guitar player when Tommy and Phil can't make it on the road, which is... So I wrote a song about him when he was in high school, and it was and he just kept playing that rock and roll, and now he's good enough to play Tommy and Phil's parts when those guys have conflicts and can't make it to tours.
How cool is that for you?
It's pretty cool because I went to nursery school with his dad. So it's an incestuous town of rock and roll and drunk drivers. Like me, I'm rolling, 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 rolling.
Well, Ike Reilly, it's great to talk to you. I know a lot of folks are looking forward to seeing you again, returning to the Castle Theater in Bloomington. Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
I just want to make one more plug about our show at the Castle. First of all, I love the Castle, but Brendan O'Shea is one of the great Irish songwriters. He's also a good friend of mine, and he'll be opening the show. So get there early because he's really, really great, and he'll be playing with us. And we're going to do a few St. Patrick's Day treats, a couple of Pogue songs, and a couple of old Irish ballad-influenced songs that I've written. But it's going to be a Irish punk, folk, festive rock show featuring Bloomington Normal and Monster Pawn's great Tommy O'Donnell.
Ike Reilly speaking with GLT's John Norton. The Ike Reilly Assassination plays the Castle Theater Thursday night. Doors open at 7. Music starts at 8. Discover more local music and hear from artists playing in Central Illinois on the GLT Music Podcast. Find it on NPR One or your favorite podcast app. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Find today's stories and interviews from Laura Kennedy, John Norton, and Colin Reynolds at WGLT.org. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post your comments at Facebook.com/WGLTFM. I'm Mike McCurdy. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.